Everyone, we were waiting for quorum. We had quite a busy noon hour, so my apologies. We have today several items on the agenda, including a public hearing on Senate Bill 301, which is a culmination of a lot of work on the part of a lot of people. So with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 301. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 301 contains a Dash 1 amendment, which is summarized as follows. The Dash 1 creates a planning authority in each county, which is responsible for drafting plans with respect to several aspects of officer-related use of deadly force. Those plans are submitted then to the Attorney General under the Dash 1, and the Attorney General determines if those plans are in compliance with the rest of this measure, and if so, state funds are made available to those counties on a match grant basis to facilitate the planning process and implement the plans. The standards by which the planning authority must meet include the development of a policy describing the circumstances under which peace officers may use deadly force, plan involving providing two sessions of mental health professional access for each officer involved in the use of deadly force. It prohibits the agency whose officer was involved or officers were involved in the incident from being the sole agency that investigates the incident itself. It also prohibits the agency from returning the police officer or officers involved in the incident within 72 hours of the incident to any duty in which they may be called upon to use deadly force. And then finally, the bill also makes significant changes to the grand jury process insofar as it allows the district attorney, amends the statute to state that the district attorney may present facts to a grand jury about an incident involving the deadly use of force by a police officer, and it requires the grand jury proceedings to be transcribed and released to the public unless there are findings that the public interest in disclosure is outweighed by the impairment of a criminal proceeding, the individual's right to a fair trial, or the privacy right of a victim or a witness. It also prevents the district attorney from convening an inquest jury before the district attorney has involved the issue of the involved officer's potential criminal liability.
Thank you, counsel. We're going to take a series of panels on Senate Bill 301, and our first panel will consist of Senator Gordley, Attorney General Hardy Myers, and Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard. Welcome to the committee, Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Avail Gordley. I represent Senate District 23 in Multnomah County, Central East Side, which includes wonderful neighborhoods in Northeast and Southeast Portland. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, Senate Bill 301 emerges as the result of a great deal of work by interested parties, by citizens, by community leaders, by law enforcement agencies, and by the Office of the Attorney General, who has provided outstanding leadership in getting to this day. This work began in response to a need widely and deeply felt in the Portland metropolitan area in the aftermath of a number of incidents spanning more than a decade involving law enforcement, lethal force, the deaths of unarmed citizens, and the grand jury process. Members of the task force working on this bill will offer testimony addressing the need for this legislation in jurisdictions across the state. Senate Bill 301 emerges also as the result of enormous pain suffered by victims, by families of victims, by law enforcement officers and their families, and by the community itself. The sort of pain that results from the sudden loss of life in dramatic and unexpected circumstances. Apart from the legislative remedies sought through this legislation, Chair Burdick and members, and as some of the witnesses here today will testify, we are aware of unhealed wounds in the fabric of our community. Witnesses will testify to that fact. These wounds lie in the hearts of a very wide circle of people. Senate Bill 301 does not seek to assign blame, to police officers who have exercised lethal force. We are aware of the emotional impact that these officers and their families suffer, and we seek through this legislation to establish policies that reduce the incidence of police-involved shootings, that provide for improved training, that yield the transparency that families and communities need when these tragedies occur, and that help the public and law enforcement to understand each other more clearly. I fully endorse the report and recommendations put forth by Attorney General Hardy Myers and the task force, and I want to thank the Deadly Force Task Force, led by Pete Shepard and Ronell Schenkel, for their remarkable work, Madam Chair. I especially appreciate the community members from throughout the state who stepped up and contributed to the discussions that resulted in these recommendations. And I especially want to acknowledge the contributions made by the police officers who shared their experiences and their personal pain in order to help the task force more fully understand the impact of the use of force on the lives of police officers and their families. It is important to recognize the task force's discernment that, and I quote from the report, events involving the use of deadly force are part of a continuous cycle involving the community and peace officers, end of quote. Key elements of this continuous cycle include training, planning, and policy. Advanced planning, which includes training and policy development, can't provide certainty about process that will minimize trauma for involved officers and affected non-police community members alike. Again, that's quoting from the task force report. Madam Chair and members, this proposed legislation and its implementation is our opportunity to strengthen the administration of justice in the state of Oregon and is an acknowledgement that the citizens of our state desire to enhance the training that our fine, dedicated public safety professionals receive. I am aware that the single feature of this legislation that is likely to draw the most comment is the requirement that a transcript be prepared of grand jury proceedings convened to examine incidents in which someone has died at the hands of a police officer. I urge you, Madam Chair, and all of the interested parties, not to get locked into this or any other single feature. I view the transcription requirement to be an important element of a complete process. I evaluate the pros and cons of transcribing this very small number of cases in the context of that larger process. In that broader perspective, recording the grand jury testimony for these cases is not a significant burden. Senate Bill 301 does not change what has happened in the past. It does not provide the explanations that those who have lost family members and loved ones are seeking. It does not remove the chaos that has intruded into the lives of police officers and their families in the aftermath of an incident involving lethal force. Senate Bill 301 does establish some degree of assurance that other families and police officers in future incidents will not suffer as these have. And that is how this bill also operates, to help heal deep wounds impacting our communities today. It is vital and necessary that we, the members of the 73rd Legislative Assembly, move this legislation as our contribution to that healing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, Senator Gordley. And I want to particularly recognize you for your hard work and involvement and true passion for this issue. It has made a big difference. And I personally, and speaking on behalf of the committee, appreciate it very much. So thank you. At this time, I will ask members of the committee if they have any questions for Senator Gordley. And it's up to you. We would love to have you, but I do understand you have your own committee. And so we will grill you and send you on your way. Are there questions?
Thank you, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Senator Gordley. Attorney General Myers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for your record, I'm Attorney General Hardy Myers and appreciate the opportunity to offer a few brief comments at the outset of the committee's consideration of the issue of law enforcement use of deadly force. When the Governor's Public Safety Leadership Council asked me to lead a review of that issue and to prepare recommendations for legislative or other action, I was certainly willing to do that, recognizing the very sensitive and complex nature of the issue. I undertook that effort with a profound respect for the work of professional law enforcement, which is foundational to our society. And I undertook that work with the belief that every Oregonian in and out of law enforcement has a legitimate interest in safeguarding the authority of law enforcement to use deadly force for the protection of law enforcement officers themselves and the wider community. At the same time, I also undertook that work with a belief that in a society in which law enforcement itself is subject to law, to a great deal of law, every Oregonian in and out of law enforcement has a legitimate interest in doing all we reasonably can to ensure that law enforcement's use of deadly force, which is the ultimate authority we grant law enforcement, is itself lawful from situation to situation. And that every Oregonian has a legitimate interest in resolving the issue of lawfulness in a way that deserves the confidence of law enforcement and the wider community as to the integrity of that process. In shaping recommendations toward these primary but also other goals, a key decision, Madam Chair and members, in relation to the Legislative Assembly's recommendations is where to draw the line between policies that the legislature is asked to directly enact as a statewide matter and those responsibilities that are to be placed on a more local basis. And the recommendations I've submitted invite some direct statewide policy choices by the Assembly itself, but also recommend that important responsibilities be placed at the local level within a structure mandated by the legislature, a structure and process mandated by the legislature. And with a view that the resulting plans will have the involvement and the support of members of the community and law enforcement at the local level, as well as politically accountable governing bodies. Madam Chair and members, I sincerely look forward to working with the committee as you consider this issue, and as you begin that consideration, I want to take just a moment to extend very special thanks to Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard, who, as Chair Gordley mentioned, chaired the task force, and Ronell Schenkel, who has devoted a great deal of effort to this process, and then to, of course, all the members of the task force itself and members of the community, wider community, who have contributed so much to the work that preceded my report and my recommendations. Again, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I apologize. Chair Gordley has left to go down to Public Safety, where the Department of Justice's budget is being considered right now. And if I might, I'd like to excuse myself for just a brief period and then return. And if at some later point you wish to reinsert me, if there were questions, I'd welcome that opportunity. But
sorry,
I hope you can excuse
me
for a
moment. Releasing one hostage at a time. No, we understand. Are there any quick questions before the Attorney General goes? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you for your work on this. This was a very impressive effort. Thank you. Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. You have several items on your agenda today and lots of folks who want to talk to you about this bill, so I'm going to be pretty brief in my comments. First, I'm going to describe the three basic assumptions that underlie the report and the recommendations, and then give you just a couple of highlights about a few of the elements of the Dash 1 amendments, which are intended to be a complete substitute for the printed bill, ultimately, when they're ready to be considered by the committee. So the three basic assumptions of the report have been alluded to both by Senator Gordley and by the Attorney General. The first of those is that the use of deadly force by peace officers is a matter of statewide concern. Now, we ask officers everywhere to go in harm's way in our name, and they do so for the purpose of executing statewide laws, laws of statewide applicability, and we give them boundaries that are established in state law on the use of force in the execution of those duties. The use of force very infrequently results in death, as I think you'll hear from some other witnesses today, and yet when these incidents do occur, they're obviously very momentous, both for the officer and for the community and for the other individuals involved. So the report recommends, and the Dash 1 amendments incorporate the proposition that the Attorney General has alluded to, that is, that the state should establish some basic statewide mandates, but also should create a framework within which local jurisdictions can adapt those plans, can adapt to those mandates. And that's the second basic assumption, is that the most effective responses in virtually every aspect of this difficult area of public policy are going to be responses that are rooted in local conditions. Successful approaches, for example, to building strong relationships between police agencies and the people that they serve and protect are much more likely to arise as a result of local conditions than as a result of some form of statewide mandate. The resources available for local jurisdictions to carry out the kinds of recommendations that we've made in the report are going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And so, again, local jurisdictions should be permitted a wide array of choices about how they go about fulfilling the needs that we've identified in the report. So again, to reflect this assumption, the report and the Dash 1 amendment set up a locally based planning process that nevertheless has a measure of statewide control in the form of the Attorney General's review for minimum legal sufficiency of the plans that are developed locally. And the final basic assumption is that the act of firing the gun or otherwise applying deadly force is neither the beginning nor the end of the relevant events or of the relevant public policy considerations. The more that communities invest in the front end in anticipation of the day, the rare day, and the unhoped-for day when one of these events occurs, the greater the likelihood that the response to the event will satisfy all of the complex needs that arise in its aftermath. And so the wheel metaphor that you see on the chart behind me and that appears on the front cover of the report is intended to represent the reality that how communities respond to one incident inevitably will, for better or for worse, shape the way the next incident occurs if one does occur. Let me turn then to a couple of comments about the specific amendments. Your committee staff has given you an able summary of several elements, and I'll only touch on a couple of the ones that he mentioned as well. First, as I've said, the Dash 1 amendments are intended to be a complete substitute for the printed bill. And, Madam Chair, I hope that we could incorporate in the committee's official records a copy of the Attorney General's report, because the Dash 1 amendments are intended to reflect the statutory elements of the recommendations and thus, in our view, would form part of the history of those amendments should they ultimately be adopted by the Legislative Assembly.
We will add that to the record. Thank you.
Thank you. I should also note that although we have reached the end of perhaps the beginning part of this process, this really marks, today really marks the first opportunity for people who were involved in the task force and for the broader community that we invited to comment on the task force reports and with whom we consulted, to comment on, this is the first real opportunity to comment on the Dash 1 amendments as they were only available late yesterday afternoon. And in my own review of those amendments, I've already identified four aspects of them in which it's very evident that I didn't adequately communicate my hopes to Legislative Council. And so we do hope that that we can participate in a subsequent process to help refine those amendments and bring them back to you at a future date in a form that at least irons out all the inconsistencies and presents a squared away policy choice for you. And the final comment I would make about the amendments before I give you a couple of section-by-section descriptions is that we did not ask anyone who participated in the task force to sign on to the full recommendations of the task force. So I fully expect you'll hear today a variety of viewpoints about a variety of the elements. I hope you'll hear that much of what we recommend and what's in the Dash 1 amendments marks a very significant step forward. And as Senator Gordley said, as a package, we recommend the whole package to you as a committee. But I do expect you're going to hear a variety of viewpoints, and that's understood, and we've heard those expressed in the task force as well. Sections 1 to 3 on pages 1 to 4 detail the planning process that I've described to you. That planning process would be undertaken locally by a new entity, the Planning Authority, that would be co-chaired by the district attorney and the sheriff.
Mr. Shepard, can I interrupt you for just a second? For members of the audience who may not have picked it up, this bill has been completely replaced by an amendment that copies are available on the table. So if any of you are following along, the document you want to have is the document that you can find on the table. It says SB 301-1 on the top. I just wanted to clarify that so that people don't get confused. Thank you for allowing the interruption.
The sheriff and the district attorney would head up a locally based planning effort. That planning effort would result in five different plans, in general addressing the major elements that you see on the wheel chart beside me and on the cover of the report. Those plans then would be submitted to the city councils and county commission of the jurisdiction, and this is one area where we may need to look at the possibility of also having some form of review by special districts, some of whom also employ police officers who are authorized to use deadly force. But present, the Dash 1 amendments don't anticipate the special district review, and that's an issue we'll need to look at. The Attorney General then, as I've said, would review those plans ultimately for compliance with the minimum requirements of law. Sections 4 to 6 on pages 4 to 5 describe a system by which, beginning July 1, 2006, 1 year into the new biennium, the Department of Justice would administer a fund from which grants may be issued for expenses incurred by local jurisdictions in executing and implementing the plans. All of the costs, for example, of preparing grand jury transcripts would be borne by the state of Oregon and paid out of state funds. Section 7.2 on page 6 of the Dash 1 amendments requires every law enforcement agency to adopt a policy dealing with the use of deadly physical force. Oregon law establishes the outside limits, that is, the limits beyond which an officer may commit a crime if he or she uses deadly force. But most agencies already have policies in place that describe in much more detail the circumstances under which their officers are allowed to use deadly physical force. And we believe this ought to be one of those statewide minimums, and Section 7.2 requires every agency to have such a policy in place. Section 7.5A on page 6 is the statutory statewide minimum that would forbid an individual agency from being solely responsible for the investigation of an incident that resulted in death as a result of one of its own officers' actions. Your counsel has alluded to that already. Section 7.6 on page 7 requires agencies to collect data about deadly force incidents. Here we made an interesting discovery in the course of the task force. It turns out that since 2000, there has been a federal statute in place that requires states to collect and submit to the federal government certain basic elements of data about incidents in which officers use deadly force and a death results. We discovered in the course of the task force's work that that probably has not been systematically executed in Oregon. There is an office in the Office of Homeland Security that has taken admirably the responsibility of submitting something to the federal government in each of the last 2 years on this subject. But we found that most local jurisdictions weren't aware of the reporting requirement, and so we recommend that the state adopt a state statute requiring that certain data elements be collected. Section 8, page 7, is a very important part, we view to be a very important part of the recommendations. In this wheel and cycle of events, it's clear that one of the things we want jurisdictions to do is learn from every experience and incorporate those lessons to hopefully avoid or at least minimize the circumstances under which deadly force is required to be used by an officer. One part of that would be a self-conscious examination of how one's plans worked and how well all of the procedures that the local jurisdictions had put into place had worked in a particular instance. In the course of the task force's work, we were counseled that it would be very desirable to have a statute which shielded the conclusions and recommendations from such a self-examination from admissibility in subsequent civil liability cases, so that local jurisdictions could more freely engage in a critical self-examination that developed meaningful lessons for the future. And so Section 8 on page 7 accomplishes that. Let me end my comments with the grand jury procedures, which are in sections 11 to 13 on pages 9 to 13 of the bill. These do provide for mandatory transcription of testimony received by grand jurors about incidents in which peace officers used deadly force and a death resulted. Current law permits but does not require district attorneys to transcribe the proceedings of any grand jury. So with respect to current law, one change that these sections would work is to require the recording of grand jury proceedings in which an officer used deadly force and caused a death. Nothing about the recommendation or the Dash 1 amendments requires a district attorney to use the grand jury option as a means of reviewing these incidents. There are other options available, but if the district attorney does select that option, then it would be required that those proceedings be transcribed. I want to finish with the succinct rationale for making this change in Oregon law, and the accompanying change which would cause the release of the transcript in most instances to the public. And that is in section 11.4 of the bill, and that rationale is simply this: that the use of deadly force by a police officer that results in the death of a person requires a level of public scrutiny that uniquely justifies a limited intrusion into the secrecy historically accorded grand jury proceedings. We think that that limited intrusion into the grand jury process that exists under current law is appropriate as part of the overall package presented to you in the Dash 1 amendments. We think that the grand jury piece, including and the rest of the recommendations in the Dash 1 amendments, represent a significant opportunity to improve our public policy in this area. And we're going to come back to you after we polish these amendments and urge their adoption.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your hard work on this during this task force. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, our next panel is going to be Sheriff Bob Wolf and Martha McMurray.
Madam Chair, can I ask Council a couple questions while they're coming up?
Sure, please go ahead.
And perhaps this question should have been addressed to Mr. Shepherd, but he spoke of peace officers and peace officer shootings, but yet the bill refers to police officers. Is there a difference? I think there is, but I just a question to get answered at some point in time.
Maybe Mr. Shepherd come up and address that.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, as a matter of law, I think police officer is probably the correct term for statutory drafting. I used peace officer because in the course of the task force, one of the things we heard from community members was a very strong desire that they view police officers as their partners in maintaining the peace and safety in their community. So I fell into the habit of referring to them as peace officers because of our work on the task force more than anything else.
One other question for counsel, Mr. Shepard. On line 7, page 10 of the amendment, in sub 3 of section, whatever section we're in, we have a quote of there that an indictment endorsed not a true bill. I don't know what that means.
Either one of you can take that.
I'm happy to give it a shot, Mr. Shepard. I believe that not a true bill means that the grand jury returns and affirmatively, it's the functional equivalent of affirmatively saying there is no crime to prosecute.
It's the opposite of an indictment for lay people.
Although I do not have experience as a prosecutor, and I bet there are a few other people in the room that could answer this better than I think there is an option of true bill, not a true bill, or simply to do nothing.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, your counsel is correct. The formal processes are return a true bill, which would be an indictment finding probable cause to believe that a crime had been committed. A not true bill, which is also a formal mechanism contemplated in the statute. And then the practice often in the district attorney's offices is often not necessarily to present a formal document to the grand jury, but to consult with them and to have their sense of whether a crime has been committed and simply announce that no indictment is returned. Mr. Dugan is on your witness list, and he's actively practicing as a prosecutor these days. I think he'd probably give you a more detailed answer.
Okay. Can you wait till then, Senator Byrne?
Yeah, I just have one more, and maybe again it should wait. But on page 11, line 24, talking about the testimony of the police officer, where it says sub A, when testimony is compelled, I'm not sure what that means either.
I think that would envision a situation where the, I guess one of two things, either where the police officer is subpoenaed to grand jury and therefore compelled to testify, and it may also mean, and I know Mr. King is here from the Police Officers Union, so he can speak to this potentially too, but it may mean a situation where the officer is compelled to testify by terms of his employment. My understanding from those cases is that is a function of the terms of employment of police officers.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the section, line 24 of page 11, refers to a procedure that is in existing law whereby a witness summoned to grand jury who asserts a privilege against self-incrimination can be compelled, nevertheless, to testify. And the consequence under Oregon law, most prosecutors agree, of being compelled to testify in grand jury is to grant one not only immunity against subsequent use, but because of some Oregon Supreme Court opinions, actually technically a court of appeals opinion that the Supreme Court has followed. It also, in Oregon, uniquely grants transactional immunity. That is to say, not only can our prosecutors forbidden to use, or is it forbidden that the testimony be used, but also it would have the effect of immunizing the officer or any other person who had been compelled to testify from prosecution.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Again, Mr. Dugan is an expert on these matters.
Okay, we'll put some of these questions forward as we get other witnesses. Thank you very much, Ms. Shepard. Martha McMurray, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Martha McMurray. I was a member of this task force, and I was on the subcommittee for the impact on individuals. I was asked to join this committee because I am the mother of a son who was killed by police, deadly force, and a community representative. My interest in the police use of deadly force began January 16, 1992, at about 3 a.m. in the morning. when my husband and I answered the door to find police officers who said that there was, that they had been chasing someone who they thought was in our house. In a short period of time, only about 15 minutes, we all discovered that this person was indeed in our house, had taken our 12-year-old son Nathan hostage. The police officers, many of them were there, were trying to help Nathan, but in a short period of time, several shots were fired, and the hostage taker and my son Nathan was killed. This was a complicated situation that the community was very concerned about, as are many of these situations where deadly force is used. The community was, and we were very concerned about to find out what happened and why. There was a lot of sympathy with the officers involved that night and with us, our family, Nathan's friends, etc. So from our point of view, from my husband Greg and my point of view, we wanted to know what happened that night that led to this outcome, which seemed like there could have been a lot of other outcomes that would have ended up with our son not being killed. We wanted to know what happened and what could be done, how can there be changes made so that this kind of thing would never happen again to any other family. And we, over the last 13 years, have continued to work with the Portland Police Bureau to have a voice with them about, especially we've sort of emphasize communication, that communication can be a tactic, a police tactic, that may avoid the use of deadly force, and that is an important tactic that can be taught and can be learned. In December, I was asked to be a member of this task force, which was something I really hadn't ever thought of doing or that I would be asked to do, but I said yes right away because I thought that my experience might contribute something not only to Portland, which is what we had sort of concentrated on because that's where we were or lived, but to the citizens of the state of Oregon. And the large task force was divided into these subcommittees, so I got to be involved with attending the task force meetings and then the subcommittee meetings. In the subcommittee, the title was The Impact on Individuals. And so when I came for the first time, I was surprised, I guess I shouldn't have been, but I was just surprised to find that the individuals, who those individuals were, of course I thought it was the families of the people that were killed by police, but there were people, representatives from the law enforcement agency there were police chaplains there were people there from groups that help families whose loved one has died from one means or another. And so we were really a disparate group, all having a lot of feelings about the impact of deadly force on individuals, sort of from our point of view. And in these situations, it's really hard to keep remembering that there are wounds, there are a lot of wounds that come from police use of deadly force. After several meetings, and we really all got to express ourselves and listen to each other and talk about how to help these people, how to help all these people, all the people that are involved and are wounded by these events, and made recommendations to the task force. I felt like I learned a lot by this process. I've never really had the chance to have that kind of communication with law enforcement agencies and those groups. So we came up with our report that was included in the task force report, and I think for myself, these were the things that I felt really good about that are in the report. And that is one of them is a concern for those of the families and loved ones of those who are killed by the use of deadly force. They are caught in a very complicated situation grieving and confused and uncertain of the process. And a lot of things, I think, in this bill and the report will help them better understand the process and expect and have some knowledge of what's going to happen next. The second thing is that throughout the task force there was this intent to find out the truth, that to make recommendations that lead to the finding out of truth. In these situations, there are a lot of different eyes that see things from different point of views, and that's why it's so complex. But there is some truth that can be found out, and that truth is very important to everyone. And confidence of the community in this process is so important in these very complex issues that are very hurtful. I'm also very pleased that data will be collected. That's sort of the part that leads to prevention and reduction in the use of deadly force. If we can find out how many times deadly force is used in Oregon over time, under what conditions, what officers are involved, what are the characteristics, we may know better how to prevent this kind of thing and have better tactics to use. And ultimately, we all want there to be a reduction in the use of deadly force, and that all these things relate to that. So I hope my voice, which includes the voice of Nathan's father, Greg, will help Oregon officers and the communities to trust each other more. And I think that trust may be increased by this bill because of several things: openness, understanding of what involved, inclusion of different voices. And Greg and I are still working towards the goal that what happened to Nathan will never happen again in any other Oregon, to any other Oregon family.
Thank you very much for coming. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Sure.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Bob Wolf. I'm the sheriff of Polk County, and I am the president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. First, let me say that I would like to extend the appreciation for the work that the Use of Deadly Force Task Force has put into this, and that particularly the work of the Attorney General Hardy Myers and Assistant Attorney General Pete Shepard. The effort that they have put into this certainly is to be commended, and this is a critical issue that I think is important for the citizens of the state of Oregon. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association at this point has not taken an official position on the changes here. We're going to obviously be reviewing the report. We've seen draft copies and certainly see some good things that are in this. The one issue I think that has been alluded to already here this afternoon is going to be our concern relative to grand juries. That's going to be a significant change in how grand juries have been working, and the officers that testified before grand jury and how that information will be treated afterwards. Again, there's plenty of things in the report that I think we still need to look at, and some additional work needs to be done. But I think this has gone a long ways in trying to get information available to the parties involved and the families that are involved in such critical incidents. So at this point, we'll be continuing to take a look at this from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and working with whatever further recommendations might come forward.
Thank you very much, and thank you for pinch hitting here at the last minute. We really appreciate it. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Next we'll take Dr. Alan Bethel, Eric Gablitz, and Sam Adams. And Dr. Bethel, you may have wanted to bring Pastor Haynes as well, if he's in the room. You? Maybe we could start out with Dr. Bethel.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, thank you for the privilege of addressing you on Senate Bill 301 and about the Deadly Use of Force Task Force. I'm Dr. T. Allen Bethel, President of the Albino Minister Alliance in Portland, Oregon, also Senior Pastor of Maranatha Church. I want to say, first of all, that this is a good start, a first step in a great process towards bringing us to a place what I call a workable whole. That is, where we understand the positions of the officers and their concerns, as well as understanding the position and concerns of the public or our general citizens, that we all are concerned and want all to have safety to go to work and return home safe. We also need to have protocol and procedures that are in place that address what happens when there is use of deadly force. We find that in each case, sometimes things are done in a different way. 1 year ago, we are approaching the death of Perez, and about 4 years ago to this week, Mahalia Poot. So we want to urge that the work that we're beginning to do now goes forth to produce and have those procedures in place so that it's not if, but when it happens again, we know how we are going to proceed. When we talk about the Attorney General taking or becoming a special prosecutor in each of these cases, and while the report rejects that, we think that reasons are very, very important and are many that support this, because I believe it will bring about an aid in the credibility during such instances of investigation if we would have a special prosecutor who would handle the case. Also, I want to say that I think we need to, as we continue to look at this, and there is work to be done, that we need to establish some ongoing dialogue and reporting, not only between the task force that was made up largely of individuals from the different police departments and bureaus across the state, but to bring more of community there to begin to talk about what are their concerns and what they would like to see, to bring those together along with what is being said by police officers and bureaus to come to that workable whole once again. This bill moves us towards the workable whole, and I urge that the legislature would adopt this bill and do whatever is necessary in action to make sure that this bill 301 passes and is part of Oregon law. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Are there questions? Pastor Haynes, did you want to comment as well? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
The distinguished and honorable senators of this committee, I am Pastor Leroy Haynes, Jr., the senior pastor of Allen Temple Christian Methodist Episcopal Church in Portland, Oregon, and chairperson of the Albino Ministerial Alliance ad hoc coalition for justice that have been basically handling the issues of the Kendra James case and the Perez case. We thank you for the opportunity to give the input on this issue on behalf of the Albino Ministry Alliance Coalition for Justice. We believe that the present state of the law that is written in Oregon in dealing with deadly force is detriment to policing the community and for police community relationship and working as partners to keep peace, order, and safety and to fight against crime in our communities. Secondly, it does not give the officer specific guidelines and definition of what general situations they are authorized to use deadly force. We believe that a clear definition and guidelines that as proposed in Bill 31 in reference to the Attorney General Myers' proposed bill, SB 301, will be a major step in bringing fairness to both the citizens and the law enforcement officers and in furthering the concept of community policing. Finally, we believe that in the sacredness of our life, the life of the law enforcement officer is sacred and the life of the citizen is sacred. And so we must achieve a proper balance that will benefit the total community. And therefore, we believe that Senate Bill 301-1 is a major step in bringing that balance about in the state of Oregon, that will balance the rights of citizens and the right of law enforcement for the sake of community in general. And so, therefore, we support the recommendations of Attorney General Moss.
Thank you so much. Are there questions from the committee? Commissioner Adams, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Sam Adams. I'm a resident of North Portland and the newest commissioner for the City of Portland. In terms of my experience on this issue, I served as Chief of Staff to the City of Portland's Police Commissioner for 11 years under Mayor Vera Katz. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Chair Burdick for the opportunity of giving me some time today, and especially early in the list of witnesses. I want to make note that while the issues surrounding the use of deadly force are important to Portland citizens and elected leaders, the City Council of Portland has not developed a stance on this issue at this time. Therefore, I'm representing myself and the many Portland constituents that I have been speaking to on this issue for a number of years. Regardless of your point of view of who is right or wrong in any specific case, it is a tragedy when an officer has to use deadly force. My city has been convulsed by a number of high-profile tragedies of this nature. But we are not the only city. Although we are the city with the most statewide media outlets, this is not only a Portland issue. At the outset, I'd also like to acknowledge the discomfort that discussing this issue raises for many police officers. I want to acknowledge up front and thank Portland's police officers for their good efforts to protect the safety of Portlanders. And like Senator Gordley alluded to in her testimony, I am not assuming right or wrong in future cases, and I am here to promote trust between citizens and law enforcement officers. My testimony today will focus on the issue of providing for more transparency in grand jury proceedings when it comes to reviewing officer-involved use of deadly force. I want to appreciate and thank the extensive proactive work on the part of Attorney General Hardy Myers and his task force, Senator Avell Gordley, and the Albina Ministerial Alliance, two of members seated on either side of me today. The many people who obviously put in a great deal of knowledge and effort into this study. With this report, Attorney General Myers has thoughtfully offered a very useful report that promotes a comprehensive approach that begins with extensive planning, includes adequate training and education, recommends prompt professional investigations, requires transparency during the process to resolve potential criminal responsibility, and lays out a strategy for data collection, debriefing, and evaluation. I want to focus my testimony on the requirement that all testimony received by the grand jury about officers who caused death by the use of deadly force should be transcribed verbatim, and unless the officer is indicted or some other compelling reason is shown, be promptly publicly released. I believe that this releasing of the transcript of grand jury proceedings provides a needed transparency that is crucial for the reputations of both the officers involved and for the community's sense of trust in law enforcement. The current system of grand jury proceedings being secret is intended to protect witnesses, victims of crime, grand jurors against retaliation, and innocent persons against wrongful accusations of crime. Instead, it enhances distrust. It does little to protect the reputation of the officer whose actions are determined not to have been criminal. And as quoted in the report, many police officers believe the community and media poorly understand the challenges faced by officers, and therefore that officers who use deadly force may be subjected to unrealistic criticism. Conversely, some individuals in communities are deeply suspicious that our current system does not provide fair evaluations of the conduct of police officers. All citizens need to be both protected and served by our legal process. A more transparent system will do a far better job of establishing a base of understanding that a system that does not record, much less publicly reveal, its proceedings. In short, to summarize, the release of grand jury transcripts of officer-involved shootings will provide for more transparency, which will grow the trust between the police and the community. I appreciate the time that you've given me here today, and I strongly encourage you to support this provision in Senate Bill 301.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? I know you have to get to another meeting, so...
I just have one question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Whitson.
Is there any precedent for making public grand jury proceedings in any other situation?
My understanding is that other states in this country, under different circumstances, do release grand jury transcripts. In the state of Oregon, in the city of Portland, I'm not aware of it, but I'm not an expert on that issue.
Could you or could someone else within that framework provide to the committee some examples of other states that do that with grand jury proceedings, please?
What was your question, Senator Wickett?
The question was, could you or could someone else within the group provide us with some information on other states that do require or that do allow the release of grand jury proceedings and under what circumstances?
Senator Whitson, we could probably have the resources to get the answer to that by calling, the council has offered to call the National Conference of State Legislatures, which probably has that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. You can be excused if you need to get your other meeting.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Gablix. I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, also known as DPSST. I'm here to provide testimony on Senate Bill 301 on behalf of the Training Committee. On behalf of our work group, we'd like to thank the Attorney General as well as all the other committees for their efforts. And truly, to recognize in Senate Bill 301 that training is recognized as one of the core elements of this issue. The committee that we had included city, county, law enforcement officers, as well as those from the Oregon State Police and our staff. And what I wanted to do is just share just a few minutes of looking at the past, some things that we're doing currently, as well as some challenges that we have. In the past, training delivered at the academy was in a lecture format. We provided 10 weeks of basic training to newly hired police officers, and we had very limited facilities in which to do that in. Presently, there's a number of positive changes underway. We have transitioned our training to a scenario-based format. We have Range 3000 technology, which is an integrated use of force decision-making, basically computer training system, which we do have on display downstairs in room 50 today until 5 p.m., which allows us to basically train officers in very rapid decision-making movements that could involve use of force. So we're very pleased to have that technology in place and deployed statewide. We are also very pleased that the legislature is moving forward, and we are in the process of building a new statewide public safety academy here in Salem, which will be completed in the summer of 2006. Also, the legislature has authorized basic police training for entry-level officers to go from 10 weeks to 16 weeks. One of the positive changes that will allow us to do is to not only provide more training, but also to look in the manner that we provide that training. One of the things that we look at is integrated threads, is a term that we use. And while we may be talking about a use of force incident, it's not just a standalone event. It involves the communications involved between all the parties involved. There could be cultural diversity issues, other issues that the officer truly has to make decisions in that are rapidly escalating that could result in the use of fatal force. The other thing that our police policy committee and our board has moved forward on is a maintenance certification standard for police officers, and currently we're looking at a physical ability test for newly hired officers. With this said, there's a lot of good things going on, but there are a number of challenges that you'll see not only in Senate Bill 301, but also in the larger report. Those challenges are that the training for police officers involves perishable skills, meaning that they need to be maintained on an ongoing basis, whether or not they're being used or not. You never know when you're going to need those, what shift you're working, what part of the state an event happens in, but the community expects that officer to be able to make those decisions immediately and with a great deal of positive outcome. The other challenges are regional training, statewide as mentioned within that report. The challenge to us is that that program has actually had some reductions due to budget cuts in the past. The other challenge that you see is that obviously all of the different issues involving training involve the need for instructors to provide that training. That is an ongoing challenge of not only DPSST, but all of the agencies in the state to not only develop those instructors, but maintain them. We've mentioned that the basic police course will be going in 16 weeks. The challenge that we have is that national average has moved forward and it's now approximately 22 weeks. So even when we open the new academy and we move to 16 weeks, we'll be below the national average for the training of newly hired officers. The other issue that comes up in the senior report is emerging technology. Currently, the programs at DPSST do not cover less than lethal options. In the 16-week enhanced program, we do not have the time to adequately cover that information. The other issue that is also important that you'll see in your report deals with the trauma of those officers involved in use of force decision-making events. Currently in the 16-week proposal, we will add 4 hours of training to that important subject. What we have handed out to all of you is a book written by Dr. Larry Blum that deals with officers who make decisions involving deadly use of force under pressure. The one incident that I want to share with you out of this book that's very interesting is that, unfortunately, roughly 100 police officers die in the line of duty each year in this country serving their communities. The sad thing that Dr. Blum discusses is that roughly 3 times that number of people involved in law enforcement commit suicide. So while we have programs in place to assist, obviously 4 hours of training in our 16-week program isn't going to do what needs to be done, so that's a challenge we have to work on. In closing, we'd like to thank you for this opportunity to share this with you. We are working with Senator Gordley and the members of the Public Safety Ways and Means Subcommittee on the challenges that we've mentioned, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you very much. And if you would convey to Director Minnis our appreciation for his providing a very interesting book on this whole issue from the perspective of a police officer, we would appreciate it. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, thank you all very much. Right now, we will temporarily close the hearing on Senate Bill 301 and open a work session on Senate Bill 89, Senate Bill 208, and Senate Bill 489 for the purpose of moving those bills over to the Monday agenda, Monday, March 28th. They will not be taken up today. And for the benefit of those in the audience, I thought you'd want to know sooner rather than later. So with that move, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 89, 208, and 489, and we will reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 301. Thank you, and we will call our next panel of witnesses, which is Robert King, Daryl Gerritsen, or Brian DeLashmit, one of the two, or both, if you want, Kevin Campbell. Thank you. Start out here. Thank you.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here and to testify before you today. I particularly want to thank the Attorney General.
Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Robert King. I'm a detective with the Portland Police Bureau, and I'm the full-time association president representing 900 officers, sergeants, detectives, and criminalists in Portland. I in particular want to thank the Attorney General and Pete Shepard and all the task force participants. The use of deadly force is obviously a matter that is of statewide concern. It is an issue in Portland that is of real concern to officers and to our community, and I appreciate that we have brought a group of people together to think and talk about this in a way that I think over time will lead to a better understanding of the complexity of the use of force, how our actions, officers' actions are reviewed, how our community views our actions, how the investigations are done, etc. As an officer, And as a representative of officers, our use of deadly force is it is a hazard and an inherent risk in the work that we do for our community. We have a real concern about how our actions are reviewed, both by the local jurisdictions as well as by the state. And we also have a very real concern about how our community views us and views the review of our actions. Having said that, having used deadly force myself on two different occasions, once in defense of my life and once in defense of other officers, and running an organization that represents officers who routinely are called upon to use deadly force to protect themselves, one thing that is true for all of us is that we all hope that we never have to use deadly force, but that it is an unfortunate reality of the work that we are doing in response to this dangerous world that we find ourselves in. In Portland over the last 4 months, there has been as many shootings. In November, there was an officer who was charged by a bank robber who was armed with a knife, and the officer had to defend himself by shooting that man and killing him. There was an incident on 84 in Southeast Tolman where three officers were shot at. Two of our officers were shot. Officers returned fire, killing the suspect. In February, we had one of our officers nearly attacked by a mentally ill man with a knife, and that officer had to defend herself. And as recently as last week, you may have seen played out in the Oregonian, a man that clearly was suicidal and acted out his suicidal tendencies, requiring an officer to shoot him, the officer using deadly force to defend himself and other innocent people and innocent hostages on that call. The report, I think, is an impressive and it's a comprehensive approach to the use of deadly force. And in particular, I wanted to thank Senator Gordley for her earlier comments, or rather her suggestions, that today we not focus in particular on any one issue. I think to do that minimizes and marginalizes the importance of many of the features of the report. Speaking for myself, I see the report as a formal beginning to a process and to a dialogue, which obviously will result in law at some point in the future. So I want to thank you for allowing me to participate in the task force and allowing me to provide some comments to you today.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Gerritsen.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Senator Berg, members of the committee, my name is Darrell Gerritsen. I'm an attorney for the Oregon Council of Police Associations. The Oregon Council of Police Associations represents approximately 4,000 professional law enforcement officers in the state of Oregon. It's comprised of approximately 35 labor organizations. The largest is the Portland Police Association, and the smallest is the Winston Police Association. The Oregon Council of Police Associations would too like to thank the Attorney General and Pete and Ronell. They have done an outstanding job in bringing together a large segment of the interested parties, including the communities, all the way down to the officers that have unfortunately had to use deadly force in the performance of their duties. They've done a very nice job of putting together a comprehensive report. It covers all of the subjects. The association is generally supportive of the report and generally supportive of the end result. We all are at this point, however, neutral on Senate Bill 301-1, and I will tell you why. About 80% of the bill is outstanding. But one of the biggest problems that needs to be dealt with in this process is how we generate public accountability or public information so that the public feels that these incidents have been adequately investigated and the public is satisfied from the result without traumatizing the officers. The Attorney General has made in this bill is to provide for the recordation of grand jury testimony so that that could be available to the public. The problem is the Attorney General left in the second component, which is inquests. As long as inquests remain at the discretion of the district attorney with absolutely no rules on how they're to be conducted, the Oregon Council of Police Associations will have a very, very difficult time supporting the bill. inquests are akin to public lynchings of the police officers. Every inquest that's been conducted in the state has turned into a media circus. The officer has been forced to undergo a gauntlet of insults, humiliation, and basically a public lynching. The association feels quite strongly that inquests are an antiquated leftover from the 15th century that has no place and does not generate any kind of public acceptance of the process, at least a level of public acceptance that you could balance with the trauma on the officer. So as long as the inquest process remains either an option with no rules, or, well, basically, as long as it remains an option with no rules, the association will have a very difficult time supporting the bill. We have serious concerns about the recording of grand jury testimony. However, the association, not speaking for Portland, can live with that if inquests are gone. But as long as inquests remain, we'll find ourselves in a position of opposing the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just to clarify, what I heard you saying is that the association could live with the recorded grand jury transcripts, but the Portland Association might have more of a problem with that. Was that a correct?
I think the point that Mr. Gerritsen is making is so long as recorded, the recordation of the grand jury proceedings with the release of the testimony following grand jury is a part of 301 and inquests are still available to the district attorney to conduct, that those two together make it very difficult for us to be supportive of the bill. But while we do have, and I'm speaking more for, I'm speaking for the police association, we do have a concern, and I think some legitimate concerns about the recordation of the grand jury proceeding and their release. I think that we need to explore and discuss with a number of people. I will tell you, if there is a way for us to eliminate the potential or the possibility or the trauma of the inquest jury to officers, I think we're very open to discussions about how that might be accomplished. And if there could be modifications to the bill that would, I guess, keep that from happening, it seems to me that we could satisfy a variety of different interests by through some discussions.
So that would make you feel more positively toward the transcript of the grand jury?
Yes, Senator.
Okay. Thank you. Just trying to clear that up. Mr. Campbell, oh, are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Campbell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and served on a steering committee of the Attorney General's Use of Deadly Force Task Force. And I guess we could repeat this over and over again, and the Attorney General really deserves the thanks that he's receiving today and the hard work of Pete Shepard and Ron L. Schenkel, because what they've done is they've, first of all, they've comprehensively looked at the issues surrounding this. They have really included a wide range of stakeholders, and they've moved this whole issue into an area of productive discussion, which is hard to do when there are deep emotions attached to it. So my thanks are honest and sincere for the Attorney General's work on this, and to Senator Gordley, too, for taking leadership in this and for being committed to working with all parties to try to create something that's productive. And this has been a productive process. I want to mention just a couple items from the perspective of the police chiefs. We did have several police chiefs that participated in different subcommittees of the task force. It was a helpful experience for them. I want to mention that one of the issues that is often an issue of discussion among police chiefs is the whole area of community outreach and community relationship. And as chiefs of police recognize that many of the use of deadly force incidents right now have seemed to occur in the metro area of Portland, all of them recognize that they are one incident away from being on the front page of the paper with an incident of their own. And so as an association, we've taken a proactive perspective on the issue of use of deadly force and count on being an integral part of this discussion, trying to be proactive about it. We realize that community outreach doesn't begin at the occurrence of an incident. It's something that is done over a long period of time, and our chiefs recognize that. I don't want to repeat what Eric Skablitz from DPSST noted regarding training, but I will say that one of the best things we can do for officers, not just at a basic training level, but in an ongoing training capacity, is to provide the training that's necessary to help
one, mitigate incidents so they don't necessarily lead to use of deadly force necessity, but to give officers every opportunity to have what they need to be properly trained. Some of these can be mitigated, some don't or can't because they're done in a second, and then training must be operative. The third thing I wanted to mention really quickly from our association is another effort that we've been a part of now for 4 years, which was the creation of what's called the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. It's an entity that was created by the chiefs of police along with our public safety partners, the sheriffs and other public safety advocates, to create an opportunity for agencies to achieve accreditation, that is, to adopt core foundational policies for their agencies that are validated. And when I say validated, I guess the difference between good policy and accreditation is that these are policies that are truly operative within the agency. They're not just on paper, but they're tested. They have to be proved in a rather rigorous accreditation process. One of those policies deals with the use of deadly force. And so we are on our own right now endeavoring to bring the members of our associations and the agencies of the state to continue to move forward into greater levels of professionalism all the time, and policies in their agencies which are defensible and they're the product of best practices and are carefully crafted. And then we want to make sure that those are validated, that they're operative. We think that good, solid policies help. Good training helps. Those are things that are productive in this discussion. Now, to the bill itself and the language, we're looking at the details of the bill. We haven't taken a position on it. We have had a lot of feedback from chiefs regarding the task force report, and I can agree that largely positive with regard to this, that this has been a full vetting of the issues. I guess I would say that we would look forward to working with the committee as we get into more of the detail of the bill to help productively work and see what we can put together to bring this forward. So with that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share today.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Are there questions from Mr. Campbell or others on the panel? Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Next we will have Mr. Dugan and Bill Blair, county attorney from, it doesn't say where. I should know that. I represent Washington County. My apologies. Or at least part of it. Welcome to the committee. To make up for it, I'll take you first, Mr. Blair.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Bill Blair, Senior Assistant County Counsel for Washington County. I have some written testimony that will maybe save me some time in front of you and give time for others to speak. I want to emphasize that at this point, both the Attorney General's report and the amendments to Senate Bill 301 are so new that the Washington County Board of Commissioners has not had an opportunity to take a formal position on them. And so I'm kind of here with the trust of my Board of Commissioners that I'm not going to say something that will step on their desires, policies, and goals. I can also say that I have reason to believe that the Association of Oregon Counties likewise is, although has not taken a position on either of these, either the report or the amendments, generally I would expect would be in harmony with my comments and the written materials and what I'm saying today. My responsibilities as a Senior Assistant County Counsel in Washington County now for the last 7 years and prior to that for 20-some years in the city of Salem included the defense in state and federal court for police use of force cases. In that capacity, I've investigated probably from the civil standpoint between one or two dozen of these incidents, defended in court, three in federal court that have gone to trial and verdict. I can say that both from my experience and the training that I've been privileged to receive in this area, a couple of things are really basic to the use of force incident. Number one, it's always reactive on the police officer's part. I've never heard of a police officer who woke up in the morning and thought this is a nice day to shoot somebody and went out to work. The officer is always reacting to a situation that is in the control, initially, of a person other than the officer. The other thing that seems to have been a common thread running through the incidents that I've been personally involved in and what I've read also is what is some people have called the 20-20 rule. In other words, we run about 20 seconds after the first time an officer comes into direct confrontation with a person who becomes a threat. He is faced with a deadly force decision and at a distance of 20 feet or less. And so in that context, training is absolutely critical. And in that context, policies, as the chief mentioned earlier, are absolutely critical. And training is not as, it is, as Mr. Gablix has indicated, is perishable. It has to be continually reinforced. And so the importance of this bill, from the standpoint of those of us who defend civil cases and those of us who are in local government, is, I think, twofold. Number one, it provides an incentive to us in the form of matching grants to plan for and implement good, well-thought policies on a regional basis, because as the report mentions, the circumstances, the conditions, the economic climate, practically everything that makes for how a police officer does their job, other than the uniformity of the laws they enforce, is going to be different from one part of the state to another. And so focusing on countywide planning is, I think, a very important component of this bill. Second important component is that of providing the public information about what happened. My experience also would suggest that getting that information into the hands of the public generally, and in particular those who survive, people who die by the use of police deadly force, is going to reduce the number of civil claims. And certainly I have plenty of work to do without defending cases where police officers have used deadly force. I have included in the written comments, the last two pages, a quick take on some technical issues with the language of the bill, and I won't go into them in any detail at this point. The only one thing that I would add, and Senator Beyer raised the question, a very good question earlier, and that is, what is compelled testimony? My understanding, at least, and I guess I hadn't thought to ask the question, so it was a very good one, is that compelled testimony means testimony that is compelled by an officer who's required to testify notwithstanding his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination because his employer or the district attorney or somebody in authority has ordered him to testify under penalty of discipline. Otherwise, compelled testimony would mean everybody that shows up at grand jury in response to a subpoena. I don't think that's what's intended. So that perhaps could be addressed. With that, thank you for your attention. Thanks to Attorney General Myers for inviting me to participate on the task force. I think you have an excellent product in front of you, and be happy to work in any way I can to help bring it over the top and make it the best it could be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Did you feel your question was answered? Could I ask you to elaborate on that? You said they can't use their Fifth Amendment right because they are subpoenaed, because they are a witness. And correct?
If a police officer is compelled to testify because his employer says, you will testify, otherwise I will discipline you for insubordination, That testimony, especially if the district attorney has become a part of it, and Mike can speak more authoritatively than that, in effect grants immunity to the officer, and that's not exactly what we're looking for. And if it is compelled by his employer without the district attorney's participation, it at least becomes inadmissible against him in evidence.
But what about the officer themselves? If they're the officer involved,
yes.
They would still be able to assert a Fifth Amendment right. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, they would if they are not ordered to testify under penalty of discipline. But if they are ordered to testify under penalty of discipline, then they bring up that whole bag of, is there immunity in effect granted, and even if there isn't, is the testimony admissible against them in a criminal case?
That's interesting.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pisanski.
Wouldn't the other analysis would be whether or not that testimony would be admissible or used in a disciplinary action as compared to in a criminal, because I could see where you could have an officer who was on the scene, not the quote-unquote shooter involved in the shooting except for observing it, and if for some reason they chose not to testify and they were compelled by their employer, it would seem to me that that would come into play on the disciplinary and the sense of whatever contract that might be in place with management and the union or association that that officer is part of, as compared to something on the criminal side as to whether or not there is criminal conduct there.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pisanski, the basic assumption is that an employer can compel an employee to give a statement in connection with that employee's performance of duty. And the cases that I'm aware of at least don't deal with it in the context of discipline. In other words, an employee could be disciplined for failure to give a statement.
Mm-hmm.
Once they give a statement, that statement is available for use in a disciplinary proceeding. It's simply in the context of use in criminal process that it becomes tainted. You may want to ask that more directly to Mr. Gadsden, since he's the really experienced union lawyer.
Thank you. Senator Byer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I think this brings up some other issues, because as used in subsection 8 of the bill, the question I asked, it was in regard to civil proceedings. So there are some other issues here that may need to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we have Mr. King in the room, if we want to proceed with this more, with this line of questioning. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Mike Dugan. I am the district attorney for Deschutes County, which is on the other side of the mountains, and I want to add that it was snowing heavily there this morning.
That's a good thing, Mr. Dugan.
The drought may not be over, but it was certainly snowing. And I also want to thank Attorney General Hardy Myers and his Assistant Attorney General Pete Shepard for the hard work that they have done in putting together a report for the Legislative Assembly concerning the use of deadly physical force. And certainly the circle that has been presented here demonstrates some of the many areas that have to be discussed in addressing officers' use of deadly physical force in our community. But let me start out and say that I became involved in this issue in the 2003 legislature when former Senator Minnis called us together to talk about this very issue. And I was wondering why I was part of that. I hadn't been involved in an officer-involved death for several years, although we had the Gantenbein death that was litigated heavily both in federal court and through our grand jury process. And then in September of 2003, we had three in Deschutes County in successive weeks. So maybe I became somewhat of an expert. I don't necessarily believe that I'm any more of an expert than most of the police officers involved in their training on a day-to-day basis. But there I am from Central Oregon, and I'm participating with the Attorney General, and the other DA that was participating with me was Gary Williams, who's Cook County District Attorney. And I note right off the bat that none of the specific district attorneys from the tri-county areas north of here were active participants in the group, and we didn't have very many from the southern part of the state either. And I say that because I've gone around my county and I've talked with my law enforcement officers and also the chiefs and the sheriffs, and the question comes back all the time, day after day, what are we trying to do here, and how are we going about it, and why? And the big question is why, and I would be remiss if I did not express to this committee that many of the district attorneys across the state that I have communicated with, and many of the law enforcement chiefs and sheriffs that I've communicated with on the east side of the mountain, where it's snowing, view this issue as a Portland, Oregon issue. And they ask, why should you legislate for 35 other counties in the state when this is a Portland issue? We're beyond that, I suppose, because I guess the question is when the train is leaving the station, do you want to be in the engine or do you want to be on the station platform watching it go by? So we have participated wholeheartedly and with the best of our ability in this process. So I raised some other questions that I think have to be answered as well. The district attorney's concerns are about costs. I note that Section 5, on page 5 of the proposed Dash 1 amendments, contemplates reimbursements for expenses by law enforcement agencies, and yet it does not define district attorney's offices as part of that law enforcement agency that would have some expectation of reimbursement for the costs. We received an email from Doug Harkleroad, who's the district attorney in Lane County, who expressed his belief that the planning process, which is needed and is worthy and is commendable, is going to take hours and hours and perhaps as many as hundreds of hours for district attorneys in larger jurisdictions to come together with the plan and the planning process. And while it's contemplated law enforcement can be reimbursed for their expenses and participation in that planning and implementation, it does not talk about the district attorney reimbursement. And I would remind the committee about Senate Bill 6 of 1999 and 2001. In 1999, Senate Bill 6, I believe, commended the Attorney General to research how much of a sharing process and contribution process for district attorney responsibilities and functions are shared by the state. We are, after all, at your beck and call. We do what you ask us to do. You pass laws. We enforce them. And the sharing has diminished so incredibly much in the last 50 years that now the state participation in district attorney activity is less than 7% of our total budgets. So we ask you to consider Section 5 on costs. Grand jury recordation is also going to be an issue that the district attorneys are going to be concerned with. And first of all, let me say that Section 11 on page 9 is absolutely critical if grand jury recordation is going to be achieved. We believe that it is a slippery slope. And I'm happy to see that Senator Walker is here because almost all of the district attorneys agree that if recordation is going to occur, it should be by a certified court reporter, period. My sister, by the way, is a certified court reporter in Jackson County. However, there is a slippery slope there that has to be addressed by the committee. There has to be adequate language in the law that is going to protect that slope from getting steep and icy, because it becomes, we think, a court TV critics bill. It is armchair quarterbacking. When you release the transcripts of a grand jury proceeding, when that grand jury's sole responsibility is to determine whether or not a crime was committed, not whether or not it was good policy, not whether or not the police followed the policy, not whether or not the police acted within the bounds or outside the realm of the policy of the office. To determine whether a crime was committed, I think the armchair quarterback is going to have too much opportunity to second guess and become more critical of the process, even with the disclosure of the transcripts. I think it's going to call for more questions and more debate rather than to solve the public interest. The other thing that comes up in that process is the grand jury recordation is not going to be disclosed immediately. The grand jury process isn't going to start immediately. The investigation has to be concluded. That could take weeks, and hopefully it's going to be done correctly and appropriately. And then the grand jury scheduling could take another week, and the public is still going to be clamoring for these questions and the information, and they're not going to get it, and they're still going to be angry, so I don't see how that is going to necessarily answer that. But we're beyond that. Will it serve to provide public confidence or inspire more debate and criticism? We think the latter. The slippery slope can be extended beyond that, though. If I'm a police officer and I'm involved in a deadly incident where I use my physical force and kill somebody, and my grand jury has to be recorded, how come the next person, for instance, Senator Brzezinski, since I'm looking at you, if you kill somebody, how come you don't get yours recorded? You're not a law enforcement officer. Is there a due process issue? Is there an equal protection issue? We think that those are some of the things that should be considered. I think as well that the planning process that we're going to embark upon, should this be adopted, is going to be a tremendous burden upon law enforcement agencies in some of the larger communities. Well, not so much in a community such as myself. I think I deal with 5 law enforcement agencies in Deschutes County. In Sherman County, where there has recently been a death as a result of officer-involved shooting, there's 1 police agency and 1 district attorney, a part-time district attorney at that. I've been asked to participate and assist in that investigation. So the costs, the timelines, and the process that we're going through, while needed, is going to be expensive. We ask the Senate to consider that in this bill. Let me answer the question about compelled testimony. I think in the legislative, or at least the proposal in the Dash 1 amendment here, talks about compelled testimony. That would be, Senator Beyer, if I ask you to come to grand jury and you came voluntarily and testified, that's not compelled. If I gave you a subpoena and you came because I subpoenaed you to grand jury, that would not be compelled, and if you testified. But if you got to grand jury and said, I don't want to testify, I have a Fifth Amendment privilege not to. What I say may incriminate myself. And if I wanted you to testify anyway, I would have, there's a procedure where I would take you before a judge, and I would have that judge order you to testify. And once you were ordered to testify, you would have immunity, period, from criminal prosecution. Not transactional immunity, but transactional, for the whole transaction. In a police officer's role, and as policies for his work, he would not have to respond in a personnel investigation for his behavior if he thought it would be injurious to his position, if he thought it was going to be incriminating. And in the personnel investigation, his employer can order him to testify or to talk or to speak about it. That's not necessarily compelled testimony, but that testimony or statements that he makes under that compulsion there are not thereafter admissible in a criminal trial. I don't know what the civil issue is there, but it's certainly not admissible. But the officer would not have immunity from a subsequent criminal prosecution.
Okay, so, go run that by again. In the case where he's compelled to answer, how does that differ from your first scenario?
In my first scenario, the court is ordering them, and it creates immunity from criminal prosecution. In the second scenario, the officer has done something in their work, mm-hmm. and his supervisors or the chief or the sheriff want to know what he did. And if that officer refuses to answer the chief's questions in the internal personnel investigation, and they have a right to do that, he can be ordered by his superiors to disclose and talk. If in that circumstance he does disclose, whatever he discloses to the police or his supervisors in the internal investigation is not admissible in a criminal case, but it does not give the officer immunity from subsequent criminal prosecution.
I see what you're saying. So in the first scenario, he was in a criminal case, and so if the judge compels him, then he would get immunity.
And I believe that Dash 1 amendments are leaning toward the compelled testimony where you take the witness before the jury, before the judge, and order them to testify before a grand jury. I don't think that that is addressing, although it's not clear, I don't think it's addressing what we refer to as the Garrity process in the personnel internal investigations. And I beg the committee's pardon, I don't know the citation for Garrity, but it was a court case, a U.S. Supreme Court case years ago, that laid out just what I said.
Appreciate it.
Mike, that sounds like it's similar to use immunity in the second set where it can't be used in the criminal proceeding against them, but if you had other evidence that you could actually bring forward the criminal charges and prove it separate from whatever he was forced to testify through the disciplinary process, you could still go forward on that.
Chair, Senator Brzezinski, that's correct.
Provided. Appreciate it.
15 minutes.
Are there other?
I noticed that some others did not take all their 5 minutes, so I just
appreciate that. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you for your kind comments about court reporters. We are born again on the subject of court reporters on Senate Judiciary. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on Senate Bill 301? Since the Attorney General is here, do you have any closing comments that you'd like to make? Okay, well, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 301, and we will adjourn to Senate Judiciary.